morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In the fall of 1996, Congress passed by an overwhelming margin the Defense of Marriage Act, which defined marriage in the eyes of the federal government as being between a man and a woman. DOMA, as it's known, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 2013, the same year that Maryland's Civil Marriage Protection Act became law after voters here became the first in the nation to approve same-sex marriage by referendum. My first guest this morning is Roberta Kaplan, the lawyer who argued the landmark Supreme Court case that overturned DOMA. She wrote a book about that experience, and she'll be speaking about it tomorrow night at an event sponsored by the Public Justice Center. The book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. Roberta Kaplan joins me on the line this morning from New York. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for this really fascinating book. Just give us a little primer for folks who may not recall. DOMA was introduced by Congressman Bob Barr in Georgia in May of 1996. What did that law state?
It's kind of incredible when you look back on it. DOMA was very unusual law in a lot of ways. But I think one of the ways it was most unusual was the fact that when it was passed in 1996, it had absolutely no impact on anyone. And what I mean by that is what DOMA said, or what the section of DOMA that we challenged said, is that if gay people ever get a chance to get married in any state, anywhere in the country, then that marriage, for purposes of federal law, is not a marriage. It's null and void. But the incredible thing is, back in 1996, no gay people were getting married anywhere in the country. That did not happen until 2003 in Massachusetts. So it was purely a hypothetical law when it was being passed.
President Clinton signed it into law literally in the middle of the night, so no one would putatively notice. And in this book, you interpolate your own story of your own coming out, your marriage to your wife, Rachel, your son, Jacob. And you tell a touching story about when Jacob was born, the hospital personnel would not let you carry him out of the hospital because you weren't a legal parent.
Yeah, so our son was born actually shortly before I argued the New York marriage case, which was the New York court's highest court, the Court of Appeals, that I lost. And just before that, our son was born, and we had a terrible experience where he had jaundice when he was born, and so he was under the lights in the NIC, what they call the NICU, for at least 3-4 days. And when it was finally time to take him home, and we were all ready, and my wife had a C-section, so she was still pretty sore, the hospital personnel wouldn't let me do so. They made my wife get up from bed and go get him because they said that I wasn't recognizable as a legal parent.
So the impact of this law was, and one of your arguments at the Supreme Court was that there were impacts of this law that Congress did not anticipate. We'll talk a little bit about that, but first tell us a bit about Edie Windsor and her wife, Thea Speier.
So, you know, I was so lucky to be asked by Edie to represent her in this case, and I think we as a gay community and, frankly, this country are so lucky that she ended up being the plaintiff who won this case and carried this message. The life that she lived, both before she ever met Thea and then for the 44 years that she was together with Thea, is such a testament, I think, not only to bravery and courage, but to what so many gay people had to live through for so many years in ways that I think that young people today don't even understand. So just the highlights I'll give you. Edie grew up in Philadelphia. She not very far from you guys. Her father lost his business, and they lost their family home during the Depression. She went to Temple University, and while she was at Temple, she actually fell in love with another woman. But the idea back then of living her life as a queer, which is her word, was inconceivable. This was the 50s, and no one was living their lives openly as gay unless you were really willing to live on the margins of society. So she got married to a guy. That's how she gets the name Windsor. The marriage, needless to say, did not last very long. After a matter of months, she told her husband that he deserved to be loved the way he really deserved to be loved and that she needed something else. And like so many other people, myself, a couple decades later, she moved to New York, or 3 decades later, she moved to New York in order to be gay, as she put it. And then after kind of struggling in New York and becoming one of the earliest computer programmers in the country, she was at dinner one night in the Village, and a woman by the name of Thea Speier was brought over to her table. At least from Edie's perspective, it was love at first sight. According to Edie, not so for Thea. She kind of chased Thea for a couple years. But then after a couple years, they got together. And the truly amazing part of the story is what happened for the next 40 years, because Thea was diagnosed with a particularly terrible form of multiple sclerosis about 10 years into their relationship. Over time, she lost use of her legs, her arms. By the time she died, she was paralyzed. Edie has said that that diagnosis happened to both of them and that they both made sure that as little in their lives changed as possible. And we know that that's true because on the day Thea died, she actually had two patients. She was a psychologist, and she had two patients who she was supposed to see that day. Look, the one thing that I know about in life is that no one knows what life holds for you, right? We don't know. No one knows, God forbid, that you could wake up one morning and find out that day from your doctor that you have MS. But the one thing that I think we all do know is if, God forbid, that happens to any of us, we would all want to have a spouse like Edie Windsor at our side.
Roberta Kaplan, the book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. She'll be speaking in Baltimore tomorrow night on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Ms. Windsor's case centered around the fact that she was stuck with a huge real estate bill. And you write in the book that had her name been Eddie Windsor, she wouldn't have had to pay that. But because she was a woman and not legally her marriage was not legally recognized. They did, we should say, she and Thea got married in Canada in 2007, but the federal government didn't recognize that marriage. So this was a real estate case as you started winding its way through the courts until you got to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it was like a lot of great American issues. It started out as a tax issue. You know, our country started out as a tax fight too. So this was a fight about taxes. Edie, basically, when she inherited their estate, inherited Thea's estate, and she inherited the apartment that they had lived in and bought together, she had to pay a huge tax on Thea's half because, as you can imagine, the value of New York City real estate increased over the 30 years that they'd held it. The tax bill was $363,000. It was essentially a tax on being gay. And Edie decided that she felt indignant at having to pay that tax, and she decided to sue.
So you go through the lower courts, and you win in the Second Circuit Court on an argument premised on the notion of heightened scrutiny. What does that mean?
So it's complicated. It's kind of a legal term, a lawyer's term, and I hate to kind of get into legal terminology with people, but what it essentially means is that there are certain kinds of laws that if the legislature passes a law that treats certain groups of people differently than other groups of people, black people, women, et cetera, then the courts, when they look at those laws, when they're challenged, they need to look at them pretty carefully because we assume in our society that the legislature should not be in the business of passing laws that treat black people differently or women differently or now gay people differently. So that's what heightened scrutiny is all about, and I'm very, very proud to say that we won that in the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit said that laws that treat gay people differently are subject to that kind of heightened scrutiny.
And for a while, there's a question as to whether or not the Supreme Court would take up your case. They eventually did. The Obama administration and Eric Holder, the attorney general, decided not to defend the law. So your opposition in this case was a group formed by Congress. The acronym is BLAG, the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, who argued the case in support of the law on behalf of Congress. You win the case, and you do so by using a phrase, or one of the things you use as you argue it, is the notion that times can blind. So in 2013, when you win, were you able to convince the court that things were just a whole lot different than they were in 1996?
Yeah, I mean, there was no question that they were. I don't think that was the harder part of my argument. I think they all accepted the fact that there's been this sea change, as Justice Scalia called it, a sea change in how Americans understand gay people. And gay people have always been around. It's not like Americans didn't know gay people going back to 1996. What's changed is that Americans now know that they know gay people, right?
Right.
Because so many gay people have come out of the closet. And that really is the sense I use, this language, times can blind, that comes out of Justice Kennedy's decision in Lawrence in 2003, in which he held that you can't criminalize being gay. And I really do think it says what this is all about, that sometimes in our country, times can blind us to moral truths that we don't realize. And in the past, Americans didn't realize that gay people and gay couples and people like Edie and Thea had the same dignity as everyone else.
So you argued that case in 2013. At that time, there were 13 states that allowed same-sex marriage. And after the case, that number shot up to 37. And then 2 years later, in April of 2015, there was a case called Obergefell versus Hodges, in which the Supreme Court ruled that nobody, no state could ban same-sex marriage. Moving forward, of course, a lot of people, when that historic decision came down last summer, they said, well, it's still the case in a lot of places that you can be married in the morning and then go back to work and lose your job. What is the next step for the gay rights community when it comes to the law and when it comes to knocking down the remaining barriers to being treated equally?
Let me be clear. The one thing that is clear, I think, from Windsor and Obergefell is that the government can't discriminate against people because they're gay. So if you have a government job, local, state, or federal, you can't be fired anymore in this country because you're gay. But that leaves open, as you suggested, the big question, which is what about private employers? What about private businesses? And that's very much kind of a mixed map right now. There are many states like New York, that prohibit discrimination against people because they're gay. There are many other states that need to pass those laws, and there are efforts underway. We could solve the whole problem if the federal government, Congress, passed that law, and there's legislation pending in Congress. But Congress, as we all know, is not exactly energetic about passing new laws today. So one other approach that's been taken is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission actually takes the position today that if you're fired from a job because you're gay, that's sex discrimination because you're being fired based on gender stereotypes. And if that's what happened, that's already illegal because it violates Title VII of federal law.
Roberta Kaplan, the book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. The Public Justice Center here in Baltimore has named Ms. Kaplan the Francis D. Murnahan Jr. Appellate Advocacy Fellow. She'll talk about her book and reflect on her successful argument at the Supreme Court tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Walters Art Museum. The event is free, but they'd like you to RSVP. We've got a link to do that on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Roberta Kaplan, thanks so much for your time and enjoy your trip to Baltimore. Appreciate it.
Thank you.